recorded February 16, 2005, at the Beverly Hilton Hotel in Beverly Hills, California by Upcycle Media. Former Vice President Al Gore speaks on global warming. Title of program: The Climate Crisis. What You Don't Know But Should. Please feel free to copy and share this file with those that may have an interest in this material. Thank you for listening.
On behalf of the host committee, I want to thank everyone for coming, and I want to extend a special welcome to NRDC President John Adams. John, wave your hand. Executive Director Francis Fiery, and Climate Change Director David Hoffman for joining us. Also, Assemblywoman Fran Pavley. This is an amazing moment for NRDC. She authored our President of the Study Global Warming Book, AD 1493, and we're really glad she's here. And I just want to acknowledge former California Energy Czar David Freeman, who I love for his leadership on programming. David. Okay, turn on your cell phone. That's something someone told me to tell you. Okay, tonight's presentation was planned for one reason. We want you to know what we know. We are convinced that if the truth about global warming is heard, American citizens would not put up with another day of spewing power plants and low-efficiency cars. There would be a public outcry in this country, the likes of which have not been heard since the Civil Rights Movement. In fact, this is about the ultimate civil right, the right to protect the things we share and depend on, the air, the water, the seasons, the climate. We cannot fight this without everyone's involvement, and the environmental community cannot shoulder this work alone. This is bigger than any one group. This is about all of us. So I think it is so fitting that on this particular day, February 16, 2005, the day the Kyoto Protocol goes into effect in 140 countries, but without the participation of the world's biggest polluter, the United States, that we all gather to hear the facts and to hopefully start heeding the warning. And who has been warning us? Well, how about over 2,000 scientists from over 100 countries? How about professors from Harvard and Stanford and Princeton and Yale? How about the Pentagon? How about the esteemed government agency NASA? British Prime Minister Tony Blair, former President Bill Clinton, UN Weapons Inspector Hans Blix, Republican Senators McCain, Hagel, and Snow, all the environmental groups in the country. How about the National Academy of Sciences, the National Council of Christ Churches, a huge coalition of rabbis, priests, and ministers, Business Week magazine, National Geographic magazine, U.S. News and World Report, even the Drudge Report. And just this week, the op-ed pages of most major newspapers in the United States. We are being warned and warned about a looming crisis. And yet, our government is doing nothing to stop it and nothing to prepare for it. One of the earliest voices of distress was a young congressman from Tennessee who first started talking publicly about global warming, would you believe, in 1976. That blew me away, actually. He helped organize the first congressional hearings in 1978. As a senator, he helped plan the first Senate hearings in 1988, and he led the charge to ratify the historic 1992 UN Rio de Janeiro Environmental Conference. As vice president, he convened a special White House summit of the country's top meteorologists and was instrumental in furthering the Kyoto negotiations. Trust me, this guy wrote the book on how to protect the planet. That was a joke. He asked if he'd write a book. I think it is truly poetic that we have here with us this particular evening one of the first and most persistent voices of concern. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome former Vice President Al Gore.
So many friends here and a lot of new faces, and I want to start by expressing my thanks and my admiration for Lori Davis. She is a powerhouse like I've never seen. I really appreciate it. And along with Lori Davis, I want to express thanks to the other members of the host committee, Elizabeth Wyatt, Gigi Grazer, Kelly Meyer, Colleen Bell, Sophie Howard, Heather Thomas Brittenham, Gwen McCaw, and Julia Louis Dreyfus. Thank you all. I want to acknowledge my wife, Pippa, who is here. And my daughter, Kristen, who is here with me. I want to thank all of the environmental groups who have joined in support of the action item that I'll talk about after my presentation here. I want to especially acknowledge the personal presence of John Adams from NRDC as the board appreciate that. And, you talked about David Freeman being here as a Californian. He's a Tennessean, you know. He was a Tennessean before he was in California. I haven't seen David yet, but I look forward to it. Also, I want to mention a new resolution being introduced by Senator Dianne Feinstein and Senator Olympia Snowe, and I'll talk about that after the action item also. But let me begin here, and I want to invite your attention to this screen, and you may have noticed this screen up here. I want to run through a number of pictures and then throw it open to your comments and questions. And I'd like to start with this image for several reasons. This picture has been credited by some historians with really launching the modern environmental movement. This was taken on Christmas Eve, December 24th, 1968, on the first of the Apollo missions to go around the moon. There were three missions that orbited the moon before the Apollo 11 landed on the moon. This was Apollo 8. And when they lost radio contact on the dark side of the moon, there was naturally a lot of suspense. And when they finally made contact again, they looked up and saw this picture. And the rookie astronaut on that mission, Bill Anders, snapped this picture, and it's one of those pictures that has it has two names, Earthrise and the Blue Marble. And within 18 months of this picture being taken, the first Earth Day was organized, and the National Environmental Policy Act, and the Clean Water Act, and the Clean Air Act, and within 3.5 years, the first World Environment Day was held. Images have a power that words do not. And this image enabled many of us to see for the first time our planet as it looks from space. The next picture was taken on the last of the Apollo missions, halfway between the Earth and the Moon. This was taken on December 11, 1972. Both of them were in December, so you see Antarctica peeking out. And this is the most commonly published photograph in all of history. Nothing else is even close. 99 times out of 100, when you see a picture of the Earth, whether in an advertisement or a textbook or whatever, it is this exact same picture, the same storm off this Cape of Good Hope, it's the same thing. And I actually, folks at NASA, I'd like some other pictures. I took down pictures of some dead white guys in my White House office and put this, a few birds in this box. And after 6 or 7 years, I said, I'd like it like another one. And they said, there's really not another one like this. And one reason is the sun was directly behind the spacecraft, behind the moon and behind the spacecraft. So it's a fully lit disk. Now, the next image I'm going to show you, this is the most commonly published photograph in history. The next one is everything. I dug it out of the NASA archive. This is the last picture from space that we have of the Earth, because we haven't gone to the moon since then. We just have the near-Earth orbit picture. There's one exception. When the Galileo spacecraft was leaving Earth's gravity to go out and explore the universe, it turned around and took a time-lapse set of pictures to show one day's worth of rotation. And it's the only home movie we have of the Earth. And so this is what that looks like. You can see the sun's reflection on the ocean. Here comes Africa. Isn't that beautiful? This image is made by a friend of mine in Santa Monica, Tom Van Sant, who took 3,000 separate satellite images from near-Earth orbit over a three-year period and carefully selected pictures that would give a cloud-free view of every square inch. And I'll show you a few images here. Now, I'm going to tell you a quick story about two teachers I had. One that I didn't like very much, and the other one that was a hero to me. The first teacher was one I had in the sixth grade. And when we studied geography, he would pull down a map of the world that looked pretty much like this picture. And a classmate of mine in the sixth grade pointed to the... Can you see that red dot?
No.
Okay. A friend of mine in the class pointed to the outline of South America's east coast and Africa's west coast, and he said, did they ever fit together?
Mm-hmm.
And the teacher said, of course not. That's another ridiculous thing I've ever heard. And the student went on to become a drug addict and a and the teacher went on to become a science advisor in the current. The teacher had an assumption in his mind that continents are so big they obviously don't move. But they do move, about a foot a year in this case, and they did fit together. And continental drift was arrived at in principle in the 1930s. Alfred Wegener, the discoverer, who actually discovered it ironically in Greenland, as I'll come to later, was ridiculed and ostracized for 30 years. But in the 1960s, the theory was accepted. And of course, the tragic tsunami occurred because of the plate tectonics that now everybody accepts and understands. But the teacher had this assumption. Continents are so big, they obviously don't move, illustrating the famous Mark Twain aphorism that what gets us into trouble is not what we don't know, it's what we know for sure that just ain't so. There is another such assumption that many people have in their minds right now that serves as a barrier to seeing clearly what the climate crisis is all about. The assumption is the Earth is so big, we can't obviously have a lasting harmful impact on it. And that used to be true, but it's not anymore. And one reason is that the most vulnerable part of the Earth's environment, as seen from this picture from space, is the thin shell of atmosphere. From here to the top of the sky is not as far as it is from here to LAX. Just a few miles. And that thin shell is now being filled up. The official way of describing global warming is, of course, and I won't waste your time on this very much. Everybody knows this. Solar, the light waves cut through the atmosphere in a hot wavelength, and then some of it is re-radiated to space in the form of infrared radiation. But some of the outgoing infrared is trapped by this atmosphere, and that's a good thing, because it keeps the atmosphere relatively stable. The problem is this shell of atmosphere is being thickened by the unprecedented amounts of pollution, and as it gets thicker, more of the outgoing infrared radiation is trapped. That's global warming. Now, that's a conventional explanation. This is a much better way to think of it.
Global warming, or none like it hot! You're probably wondering why your ice cream went away. Well, Susan, the culprit isn't foreigners, it's global warming.
Global warming?
Yeah. Meet Mr. Sunbeam. He comes all the way from the sun to visit Earth.
Hello, Earth. Just popping in to brighten your day. La 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 la. And now, I'll be on my way.
Not so fast, Sunbeam. We're greenhouse gases. You ain't going nowhere.
Pretty soon, Earth is chock full of sunbeams. They're rotting corpses heating our atmosphere. Fortunately, our handsomest politicians came up with a cheap, last-minute way to combat global warming. Ever since 2063, we simply drop a giant ice cube into the ocean every now and then.
It's like
Daddy for 2063 getting rain. Of course, since the greenhouse gases are still building up, it takes more and more ice each time. Thus, solving the problem once and for all. Once and for all!
My daughter Kristen worked with Matt Groening's crew to put that. This is the second teacher I want to tell you about. And he's the whole reason that I got involved in this issue. Back in the 1960s, I took a class from a California scientist named Roger Revelle. He showed our class this graph. And what it represents is the first measurement of CO2 in the Earth's atmosphere. Back in 1957, there was a thing called the International Geophysical Year, and scientists around the world asked questions that had never been explored before. And Roger Revelle, along with a man named Bill Keeling, and Keeling is still alive, although Revelle is not, they went out to Hawaii in the middle of the Pacific, far from any industry, and said, okay, we're going to measure every day. And on the top of Mauna Loa, they measured. Okay, so the first, he showed this to his class of undergraduates in the 1960s, the first measurement. And I went, wow, this is interesting, because you can see that the measurements are going up. But why is it that each year it goes up and down? Well, he provided the answer to that. If you look at the landmass on the Earth, most of it is north of the equator. Very little bit is south of the equator. So most of the vegetation is north of the equator. And when it's springtime, as it soon will be here in the north, the leaves pop out in the northern hemisphere and breathe in carbon dioxide, so the amounts in the air go down. And when the northern hemisphere is tilted away from the sun, the leaves fall and the Earth exhales carbon dioxide and the amount goes up. So it's as if once each year the Earth goes. And so we started his measurements in 1958, and the pattern became clear in the first few years' worth of measurements. Right around here is where he showed our class these measurements. I watched it afterwards, and after a few years, you think, okay, maybe that's just, an anomaly. But over the years, it continued to go up. And by 1976, when I went to the Congress, I organized the first hearings and got my old college professor to be the lead-off witness, naively thinking that if hey, my colleague just heard what I had heard, we'd be on the way to solving this problem. It didn't really work that way. When I went to the Senate, I organized these science roundtables and made this an issue in 1988 when I ran for president as a young man, and 92 when I went to the White House with Bill Clinton, got a carbon tax put into the economic plan, and one House of Congress passed it, the other didn't. In 97, I went to Kyoto to, along with many others, help to break that deadlock and get a treaty. In 2000, then Governor Bush pledged that he would regulate CO2. And said, it's a big problem, and I'll do something about it. He broke that pledge. Here we are in 2004, and as you can see, it has continued and will continue until we do something about it. And now the effects are beginning to be really obvious all around the planet. This is Kilimanjaro 35 years ago and more recently. This is the top of Kilimanjaro. My friend Lonnie Thompson at Ohio State, the world's leading glacier expert, took these pictures, and here he is a couple of years ago on the top of Kilimanjaro with a pitiful remnant of one of the great glaciers that used to be there. Within 15 years, there will be no more snows of Kilimanjaro, no more glaciers there. This is a glacier in Latin America 100 years ago, and today, nothing. In China, the Himalayan glaciers are beginning to break apart and melt at an extremely rapid rate. In our country, Glacier National Park went to the top of that a few years ago. It's even lower now. Within 15 years, this will be the park formerly known as Glacier. This was a big tourist attraction in the 30s. This is the same site today. This is Peru 15 years ago and today. Argentina 20 years ago and today. This is the Alaska and Columbia Glacier. Year by year, the retreat is very, very rapid. In the Alps, this glacier has retreated even more. And this is the border area between Italy and Austria, where a few years ago, some hikers were walking along and looked down and said, oh, there's a 5,000-year-old man. And you don't see that very often. And the reason is that the ice hasn't melted there in 5,000 years. And this is happening all over the world. Now, my friend Lonnie Thompson studies glaciers and puts these core drills down through the glaciers and pulls them back up to analyze the ice. And what he's looking for is this. Little bubbles of atmosphere are trapped when the snow falls and when the ice forms. And every year, there's a different layer. You can see it in these mountain glaciers. Each year is demarcated. So they can count back the same way a forester reads tree rings. And they can look at the amount of carbon dioxide in the bubbles, and they can also measure the temperature because of something that happens with the isotopes of oxygen, and that's above my pay grade, but it turns out to be a very accurate thermometer, the relationship between oxygen-16 and oxygen-18. So here's what he found in the temperature record for the last 1,000 years in the glaciers. This is 1,000 years ago, and this is the present time. Blue is cold, red is warm. And I show this for two reasons. First of all, the so-called skeptics, or naysayers, they think, oh, this is a cyclical phenomenon. There was a medieval warming period. And yes, there was. Here it is, right here. And there was another one. But compared to the present time, it is nothing. And the second reason I show this is that glaciers really do not care about politics or ideology. They just melt for free. They're not influenced by the news or anything of the sort. Just recently, they've attacked some of the data. The data comes from all over the world and all points in exactly the same direction. This is carbon dioxide over the last 1,000 years, and this is that same graph that I showed you a moment ago, showing how temperature is spiking upward in recent decades. Now, carbon dioxide measured over 1,000 years is one thing, but when you go to Antarctica, they can measure 400,000 years. And let me spend just a moment on this. This is the present era, near to it. This is the middle of the last ice age. This is the next to last ice age and the period of warming in between. And the third and fourth ice age is back. Now, bear with me on this. There are natural cycles that affect the path of the Earth around the Sun. The orbit gets narrower and wider, and it goes like a coin on a tabletop, and the tilt of the Earth changes. These are natural cycles, but what's happening now is overwhelming them. This is CO2 over 400,000 years, and this is temperature over 400,000 years. Now, I'm showing this for two reasons. First of all, for purposes of reference, in the northern half of the United States, this current temperature is the difference between a nice day and having 2 miles of ice over your head. This much difference. Okay? The second reason I show this is that if my classmate in the sixth grade who asked about Africa and South America were here, he would say, I think they fit together. And they do fit together. The exact relationship is complicated. There is mutual causality. But here's the point. When carbon dioxide concentrations go up, temperature goes up. Fact. Fact. Here is where carbon dioxide is now. Way, way higher than at any point in the historical record. Within 50 years, within less than 50 years, this is where it is. Now, you hear the so-called naysayers kicking up dust and trying to pretend there's some controversy. There's really not. But even they never for one moment dispute this. Not for a moment. This is accepted by everyone. The only difference is they say there's probably nothing wrong with this. Well, the hell there's not. This is deeply unethical to do this to future generations. If this much temperature difference on the cold side is 2 miles of ice over your head, what's that much difference on the warm side? If even a portion of the temperature increase approximates this. This is actual temperatures since the Civil War, worldwide. And you can see while from year to year, or even for a decade or longer, the trend may dip down, the overall direction is very clear and very pronounced. The 10 hottest years in the instrumented record have been within the last 14 years. Last year is the fourth hottest year on record. They just announced that. So, a year ago last summer, just like in Chicago several years previous, this unprecedented heat wave hit. France was hardest hit, and thousands of people died. The World Health Organization says 150,000 people a year are killed by this phenomenon. It didn't get as much attention in India, but it reached 122 degrees Fahrenheit there. And this puts more energy in the atmosphere and creates stronger storms. We have seen this across the planet. In Florida this last year, this is Hurricane Jean, there were quite a number of hurricanes that hit Florida. We had an all-time record for tornadoes last year. The scientists say they don't know of a firm link between the number of tornadoes and global warming, but the evidence is building. Japan last year had an all-time record number of typhoons. Previous record was 7. They had 10 last year. Here's all 10 of them. Textbooks say you can't have a hurricane in the South Atlantic, but last year the first one ever hit Brazil. Big changes are taking place. Now, this hurricane was a few years ago, and you may remember this, it hit Honduras. Timber actually went down there to help to give our country's symbol of hope for them and to help the victims. 10,000 people were killed there. Now, here is why this connects to global warming. The scientific community now says that global warming produces a significant increase in the rainfall of hurricanes and makes the average hurricane an extra half step on the five-step scale. Here is this scientific graph from NOAA. As water temperature goes up, the wind velocity goes up, and the moisture content also goes up. This has led to more evaporation off the oceans and a 20% huge increase in precipitation over the last century in the U.S. Look in the L.A. area. The actual, year-to-year data is full of noise, but overall, North America has gotten a lot more moisture. This is from the insurance industry. These are the disasters that have occurred and the disasters that have been insured over the last 35 years. The trend is going up very rapidly. The most serious disasters that are associated with global warming are droughts, because even though there's more precipitation due to increased evaporation off the ocean, there is also a higher rate of soil moisture evaporation. And more of the rainfall comes in one-time storm events, so it doesn't recharge the aquifers. More comes as rain instead of snow. So areas like California face particular challenges with water storage. And drought is the most serious of these issues. Some of the areas of the world are affected differently. You can see in the Sahel part of Africa, the refugees in the Darfur region, many of them are coming from the area around Lake Chad, which is now less than one-tenth the size that it was just 40 years ago. This is the effect of soil moisture evaporation due to global warming in our country. A doubling of CO2, which was represented by that next 45 to 50 years, results in loss of soil moisture around 30 to 35% in many areas. If we don't act soon, and we barrel right through a doubling of CO2 to a quadrupling, then you get soil moisture losses of 60 to 65% throughout vast areas of North America, including our breadbasket. It is insane to allow this to happen. It is, again, deeply unethical to allow this to happen. All right, I want to talk about two areas in particular that are canaries in the coal mine, if you will. The Arctic and the Antarctic, because they're heating up more rapidly than the rest of the planet. Let's look at the Arctic first. This is the largest ice shelf in the Arctic, the Ward Hunt Ice Shelf. 3 years ago, it suddenly, for the first time ever known of, cracked in half. These are called drunken trees. This is not wind damage. These trees grew in frozen tundra that is now melting. And so they're called drunken trees. This building in Alaska is collapsing because it was built on the permafrost. So is this home. So is this pipeline. The recent Arctic Council report surveyed the northern hemisphere. The pink areas are the areas where there is high damage to infrastructure due to the thawing permafrost. I went up to the Arctic Ocean twice in a nuclear submarine like this one. It surfaces through the ice. The U.S. Navy has patrolled since 1957 under the ice. It started during the Cold War. And they had the only record of the ice thickness. They can only surface in 3 feet of thickness or less. And I went there to persuade the Navy to give the environmental scientists the record of the thickness of the Arctic ice cap. And this is what it shows. Starting around 1970, it started dropping precipitously. And it is now melting so quickly that according to some models, in summertime, it may be completely gone within this century. A lot of it has already melted. And the reason it melts faster, the temperatures go up faster there is this. When the sun hits ice, 95% of it bounces back out into space. When it hits open water, more than 90% of it is absorbed. So the heat builds up, and it's one of those positive feedback loops, and it speeds up the process. On a region-wide basis, it has a drastic effect. Right now, the Arctic ice cap is like a giant mirror. The sun hits it for 6 months of the year, and 95% of that energy bounces right back into space. As it melts, 90% is absorbed. So the Arctic, at the top of the world, becomes a giant heat sink, warming up far more quickly than any other part of the world. Now, the reason that's so important, among other reasons, is that the climate is a so-called non-linear system. It doesn't just gradually change. It can suddenly change. The Earth's climate is a kind of engine for redistributing heat from the equator to the poles. That's what the climate does, and it does it through wind patterns and ocean currents and storm systems. And since the heat mounts more rapidly at the poles, it changes these patterns. The average temperature of the Earth in a year-round is around 58 degrees Fahrenheit. If there's an increase of 5 degrees, which is kind of a mid-range projection, low mid-range now, that means an increase of maybe 1 degree at the equator and more than 12 degrees at the pole. So all these patterns change and are changing. This is a study from the Netherlands. And let me explain this. This is 25 years ago. These are migrating birds. The peak arrival time is April 25th. The chicks hatch June 3rd, coinciding with the peak caterpillar season. 20 years of warming, the caterpillars have a new season, May 15th. So the chicks are trying to chase it, if you will, but cannot. Many species cannot adapt to these rapid, dramatic changes. Now, that's bad news for them, but it also opens up new ecological territory, and we get invasive species. And a lot of species moving from the tropics toward the temperate latitude. This is from Switzerland. This over a 100-year period is the drop in the number of days with frost, and this is the increase in the number of invasive species directly correlating with it. Now, this happens with large animals. Polar bears, as I said, are due to be extinct in 20 years. It happens with birds, it happens with bugs, it happens with microbes. Take bark beetles. There have now been 4 million acres in Alaska that have been destroyed by bark beetles because the winter doesn't kill them anymore and they spread more rapidly. It happens with microbes. Mosquitoes go to higher latitudes and the processes in the actual guts of the mosquito speed up, and it has disease consequences. Here is what happened with West Nile in North America. It started on the eastern shore of Maryland in 1999. The following year, it spread to the west. The following year, farther. The following year, farther. And by 2003, it had covered the country. There are a lot of so-called new diseases, and there are many complex factors involved. But increasingly, experts like the doctors at Harvard Medical School, who have a whole institute devoted just to climate change and disease, say that the opportunistic spread of bacteria and viruses that were contained in more stable ecosystems now exploit these new environments. Okay, we go to the Antarctic. The Antarctic has 90% of all the fresh water in the world frozen as ice there. I'm going to focus on just two areas of the Antarctic. The first is the peninsula, which sticks up toward Patagonia. This was warned about almost 30 years ago by scientists that watch out if there's ever the breakup of big ice shelves on the peninsula. that'll be a warning you need to pay attention to. Well, of course, as many of you know, we've seen the stories about ice shelves the size of Rhode Island or Delaware or Connecticut or whatever coming off. And there have been lots of them in the last 10 years. I'm going to focus on one of them because it's particularly significant. It's this one right here. It's called the Larsen B ice shelf. And this is a picture of it from the satellite. This is about 30 miles across, and this is about 100 miles long. This may look thin. It's an illusion to think that we're seeing the ocean through the ice. That's actually, those are pools of meltwater on top of the ice. If you look at this, if you were in a little boat looking at this edge on, this is an actual picture. This is 720 feet.
Oh, my goodness.
Very, very thick ice shelf. This is a computer graphic and photography of the same exact place on the Larsen B ice shelf. Again, this is 30 miles across. The land, this is a sea-based shelf. There's land-based ice up there. Okay. The scientists thought this would be stable for 100 years. Starting on January 31, 3 years ago, in a 35-day period, it completely broke up. And the scientists were astonished, truly astonished. And they went back and look, and the land-based ice was no longer stopped up on the land, and now it comes off the continent more readily. And the land-based ice is thinning out. This raises sea level. Floating ice doesn't raise sea level when it melts. Its mass has already displaced itself. But land-based ice does raise sea level. This is really a low projection now. Sea level rise without the breakup of these ice shelves I'm going to talk about in a moment. 17 million people live in this area of Bangladesh. They're going to go somewhere. This is the area of Florida that disappears with a 1 meter increase in sea level. Sea level is increasing more rapidly now. But that's not the worst of it. I want to take you to two other areas. This is the West Antarctic ice sheet. It's pinned up on the tops of islands, the tops of which are just under the sea surface. So the water laps up underneath this ice shelf, and as it warms, it has an effect on it. But since it's propped up on top of the islands, its mass is not displacing water. The amount of ice here, if it melted or plopped into the ocean, would raise sea level roughly 20 feet. There is another ice shelf at the top of the world that's roughly the same size, Greenland. And I'm going to take it, these two are roughly equal. Greenland, of course, is just south of the Arctic Ocean. A friend of mine, Jim McCarthy from Harvard, just came back from Greenland with these pictures of what's happening on the top of Greenland now. Take a look at this. These are pools of melting water, and they resemble what they saw on the top of the ice shelf in Antarctica. In analyzing what had happened in Antarctica, they came up with a brand new understanding of what happens when this kind of ice shelf melts. They thought that when water melts like this, and then it seeps back into the ice, there's so much ice there, and it's so cold, it refreezes. But they were wrong about that. It keeps on going down to the bottom, and it leaves tunnels and holes, and it leaves the ice shelf looking like Swiss cheese. This is on the top of Greenland right now. It forms what are called moulins. Here's a picture of one from Science Magazine. This is from the University of Manchester. This is on top of the Greenland ice shelf, a massive torrent of melting water going straight down to the bedrock underneath the Greenland ice shelf. 1992, the pink areas represent the melting areas of Greenland. 10 years later, you can see the difference. This past year, the Greenland survey run by Denmark came back and reported that there are falls as dramatic as 10 meters per year. David King, Tony Blair's science advisor, looked at this evidence and said, well, we're going to have to redraw the maps of the world. A 20-foot increase would do this to Florida. A 20-foot increase would do this to New Orleans.
Oh.
Here's Manhattan. This is the World Trade Center Memorial. Never again. Is it only terrorists we're worried about? Is that the only thing we're worried about? What about a climate disaster facing all future generations? Is that not on the approved list, ideologically? Here's really what's happening. Global warming is a symptom of a deeper problem. The disappearance of living species, the rainforest, the destruction of ocean fisheries, they're all symptoms of a collision between our civilization and the Earth. And there are three factors causing it. The first is the population explosion. You know these figures. It took 10,000 generations until my generation was born before we had 2 billion people. And in my lifetime, we've already gone to 6.3 billion, on the way to 9 billion. If it took 10,000 generations to 2 and then one lifetime from 2 to 9, that's a big discontinuity, a big change, unprecedented. We got a success story in slowing the rate of increase. Good news. But the momentum is so great, it's changing our relationships to the Earth itself. Most of it's in developing nations. It increases demand for water and for food and for energy and puts pressure on land resources. It's a political issue. This is the border between Haiti and the Dominican Republic. One set of policies here, another set of policies there. The burning each year in the third world is vast. This is a computer image of the Western Hemisphere. The whiter the lights of the cities, the redder the burning forests. Typical here. In the Eastern Hemisphere, red are the burning forests. The yellow are the gas flares in the oil field. Which brings me to the second factor changing the relationship between us and the Earth, the scientific and technological revolution, which is a great thing and has brought many blessings in health and communications, to mention a few. But here's a simple formula. Old habits plus old technology have predictable consequences. Old habits plus new technology can have dramatically altered consequences. Brief example, warfare is an old habit. But warfare with spears and swords and bows and arrows and muskets and even machine guns, that's one thing. But the new technology... In the same way, we've always exploited the Earth for sustenance, and we've used technologies like plowing and irrigation, and everything's fine. But when even simple technologies on a regional scale, on a massive scale, can produce disasters like the Aral Sea. This is the fishing industry digging a canal to try to reach the shoreline. Fourth largest inland sea in the world now disappeared. Doing it again, unfortunately, with the Three Gorges Dam in China. Technology can threaten to overwhelm the human scale. We are a force of nature, and we have to take that into account. The U.S. now contributes more greenhouse gases because of our higher levels of technology than South America, Central America, Africa, the Middle East, China, India, and Indonesia and Japan all put together. This is the average contribution per person in China, India, Africa, Russia, EU, Japan, and in the U.S. If you take population into account, China plays a bigger role, but we are still way the all-time champ.
And we're the only nation, other than Australia, that has said we will not be a part of the world's effort to deal with global warming, which begins formally today. The third and last factor creating this crisis is our way of thinking. You know the old cliche about the frog that's dropped in a pot of boiling water and jumps right out again, but the same frog put in a pot of lukewarm water that's slowly brought to a boil will just sit there until it's rescued. I've learned the importance of rescuing the frog. But the frog's nervous system perceives a sudden change, but not a change that seems gradual. Global warming is actually happening pretty fast, but within the context of a lifetime, we are lulled into a false sense of complacency. I love Dire Straits. Different, I love Mark Knopfler. There's three misconceptions in our thinking. The first, isn't there disagreement among the scientists about whether the problem is real or not? No, not really. Not really. There was a study by a California, first of all, this is a misconception that is fostered by a well-funded campaign of propaganda. This reminds me of the people who say they want to reposition evolution as a theory rather than fact. Okay. 48 Nobel laureates and scientists in science have said that what's going on is really outrageous. It's been done before. The tobacco industry staved off action on the basis of the scientific conclusion of the Surgeon General back in 1964. For decades, they confused people, and they have people who are willing to pose as responsible scientists. You know, what's the guy in the White House press corps? Jeff Gannon? Huh? Yeah, whatever his name is. There are people in the scientific community that are the equivalent of Jeff Gannon. They're for hire. Some of the same people who took money from the tobacco company now take money from the coal company. Same people. Upton Sinclair said, it's difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends upon his not understanding.
Mm-hmm.
Second misconception, do we have to choose between the economy and the environment? No. The first President Bush was staving off action, pressure for action, and had a White House conference. This caught my attention, this view graph here. This was their view of the choice that has to be made. Now, just to spell this out, scale, and there are two sides to it, and on one side is money in the form of gold bars, and on the other side is the entire planet. Boy, that's tough, evidently. It's also a false choice, because without the ecological system, a lot of business plans are going to be in trouble, and there are great opportunities to make money adapting to the new technologies that can help solve the problem, like hybrid vehicles, like renewable energy, and other new technologies that we in the United States of America ought to be taking the lead on to point the way instead of trying to sue people and stop these changes. Now, final point. The last misconception. There are people who go directly from denial to despair without pausing on a realization that there is a problem and that we should try to do something about it. These people say, okay, we accept that it's real and it's this big, we can't possibly fix it. That's wrong. We gave women the vote, we cured polio, we took on segregation, we landed a man on the moon after all, we brought down the Berlin Wall, we stopped apartheid, freed Mandela, we've even solved a global environmental crisis before. The hole in the ozone layer, this is a NASA film on the hole in the ozone layer, huge global environmental problem, different era, 20 years ago, the U.S. took on that issue. Many of us pushed for it. There was a treaty signed in 1987, and the U.S. took the lead and phased out the chemicals that caused that problem. The rest of the world followed our lead, and we are now well on the way to solving that problem. So now we have to make a decision within our political system and exercise our rights to put the facts on the table and demand of the political powers in this country that something be done. But we have to keep the right perspective, because this is an issue like no other. Final image. You remember that moving picture of the Earth when Galileo, the spacecraft, was leaving Earth's orbit? One of those spacecrafts, when that spacecraft got 4 billion miles away, at the suggestion of Carl Sagan, it turned its camera around and took another picture of the Earth. Here we are. As Carl Sagan said, a pale blue dot. Everything that's ever happened has happened there. It is the only home we have. And to threaten it, to risk it, to damage it recklessly, as we are doing now, is the height of immorality. That's why so many faith-based groups are saying, hey, wait a minute. This is something that is an ethical issue. It's a moral issue. But it has to also be a political issue. And we have to keep our eyes on the prize and solve this problem. Thank you very much. But before that, be thinking about your questions. They're going to pass out cards on the poll. And I'd like to ask Lori Davis to help me with this. While you're thinking of your questions and writing them down, let me ask you to help me with an action item. The state of California has stepped into the vacuum left by the Bush White House and said if the federal government is not going to act, we'll act. And we'll ask public standards for auto emissions. There are many facets of this problem. This is one. And on this one, California is doing the right thing. But all of the auto companies have filed a lawsuit to try to block California's law. If they want to sell consumer products to us, they ought to know that we don't want them to choose the future. We want them to help build the future. We don't want them to litigate. We want them to innovate. So we have a letter that we would like to ask you to sign. And the groups that are supporting this effort include the Environmental Defense Fund, Natural Resources Defense Council, Defenders of Wildlife, Greenhouse Network, Amica Conservation Voters, MoveOn.org, Natural Wildlife Federation, Riverkeepers, Sierra Club, Union of Concerned Scientists, U.S. First, Waterkeepers, Working Assets. We would like you to join that list, and I'd like to ask Lori to say some more words about that.
Collect these at the end of when you walk out the door, because we're going to Xerox them and we're going to send them to all the auto companies. So you're going to sign one, we're going to Xerox them for you, and we're going to send them. And let me just say this, move on today, put this up on their, they send it out here to a portion of their email list. Within 1 hour, 6,000 letters went to the auto industry. Now if they can do that, what can this room do? Now, the other thing is that there's websites on the blue sheet that you can go to that will provide you links to NRDC and various other groups, and you can send a viral email message out to your friends and them to sign as well. And the first couple hundred people who hand them in, they get this very groovy soft little warning bracelet that is made by Ruth, and soon we're going to have that on websites too, so everyone can start lining up. And if you don't line it, your kids will, okay?
I'd like to thank Lori Davis again for being the president. And if you've got questions, put them on up, and I'll ask Lori to pick out which ones you want.
What else besides Kyoto can the U.S. do to fight global warming?
Kyoto is just the beginning. Kyoto is the first step. By itself, it's not enough to make much of a dent, but it can begin a new dynamic. It has already started an emissions cap all across Europe with a trading system so that resources go to the most efficient ways to reduce carbon dioxide. Other nations have taken steps far in excess of what we have done. China now has tougher emissions limits on automobiles than we do. We American cars made here in the United States can't be sold in China because we don't meet their environmental standards. So we can have tougher environmental standards. We can encourage with subsidies the development of clean energy and reduce the existing subsidies for the irresponsible use of technologies that are creating this problem. The truth is, this is going to be incredibly difficult to solve. Incredibly difficult. Some changes have already been programmed into the system. But the worst changes must be prevented and can be prevented if we bring about a sea change in the way we think about this. We have to throw off the illusions. As Lincoln said at the height of the Civil War, as the world is new, our case is new. We must think anew, and then we will save our country. We have to create a critical mass of understanding about how serious this problem is, and then demand that those in leadership positions in politics and in business and in every institution be a part of the solution. If we devoted one-tenth of what we sent to the Iraq war to solving this problem, we would be well on the way to solving We seem to be having our attention focused on phony crises like weapons of mass destruction in Iraq and the so-called need for privatizing Social Security, because that serves purposes that can't be accomplished on a straightforward basis. But when an honest-to-goodness real crisis, unprecedented, is staring us right in the face, we're told to look the other way and don't pay attention to it. This will change when we throw the scales away from our country's eyes and look squarely at the real crisis that's facing us and demand that action be taken.
Why do you think that the media is not getting the global warming message out to the masses?
I think the media... I'm sorry? Why has the media not been getting the message out? That's actually a complex question. I'll spend just a moment on it. I thought a lot about this. I think it's a very serious problem. I think the media has changed in America. I think the nature of our public forum, that space in which the conversation of democracy takes place, has deteriorated dangerously. America came into being at the height of a movement known as the Enlightenment, when the rule of reason was held out as the source of authority in the world. The printing press had led to the wide distribution of knowledge in popular languages, and the ability of every individual to enter that public forum on a pretty much equal basis if he or she could read and write. And they could take information out and they could put information in. And it was a meritocracy of ideas. Some ideas would rise and others would fall depending upon how they were measured against the rule of reason. The feudal lords that held people under their thumbs could not stand the power that came to individuals when they learned to read and gathered knowledge. They had enough power to hold off political change, but the migrants that came here to the New World brought the seeds of the Enlightenment with them. And here, Thomas Paine wrote an essay and put it into the public forum. Benjamin Franklin printed it, and it rose, and the revolution took place. And our founders met in Philadelphia and exchanged the most complex political ideas that have ever been discussed in the history of our species. And they were, those debates were shared with the public in newspaper essays, some of them collected as the Federalist Papers. But there were 34 other essay series going on. Fantastic. The people wouldn't ratify the convention until they protected the freedom of the printing press. And that was the basis for American democracy and our self-government and dialogue. The media has changed. Fewer people read newspapers today than 40 years ago, even though there are 100 million more Americans. In the 1960s, television surpassed newspapers and does many great things, but it is a medium that's not accessible to individuals and is now owned, the gateways are owned by a shrinking number of corporations that are no longer dedicated in their core to news gathering. They have divisions that have news gathering. They are conglomerates, and they have a bottom line. News and entertainment have merged. And the public forum is now controlled by gatekeepers. The internet is a challenge to this system and a source of great hope. But television has a dominating presence, and it is not open to the vigorous debate of democracy in the same way that the print media was. Subject for a longer discussion. But the bottom line is this. We have to take this into our own hands. We cannot rely on the media. They are not doing the job. Let me give you one quick example, then we'll go on. A California professor in the University of California, San Diego, Naomi Oreskes. Is that her name? I think that's her name. Yeah. She and her graduate students recently completed a peer-reviewed study of every peer-reviewed article on global climate change for the last 10 years. Of almost 1,000 peer-reviewed scientific articles. Not a single one of them disagreed with the central premise that human civilization is causing the warming of the earth. Not one out of 1,000. 900 some odd. But some media outlets will put that as one opinion, but there's a science fiction novelist who thinks that's wrong. There is also a massively well-funded propaganda campaign that I referred to that must also be confronted. They're manipulating, they're outsourcing reality. They're creating an illusion and trying to substitute it for the real world that we have to respond to.
Higher gas taxes are unpopular but effective in reducing consumption. What do you think about raising gas taxes?
The political hot button issue. I proposed a carbon tax as part of the 1993 economic plan. It was shaped into a BTU tax, and as I said, one House of Congress defeated it. It had a little residue as a 5-cent gasoline tax, which was a political albatross. We have to get accurate market signals for the real cost of the decisions that we make. How many wars in the Persian Gulf have we had now over the last 20 years? How long are we going to allow our national state to be held hostage to a fragile area of the world that controls the largest source of a substance to which we are addicted? The metaphor of addiction is not one that I use casually. An addict, as an individual addict, will take increasingly desperate measures to continue gaining access to the substance of his addiction. We're now consuming 80% of the savings in the world with 5% of the world's people. Our trade deficit, largely because of oil, is now so huge that it threatens the value of our dollar and exposes our economy to massive risks. Coupled with the budget deficit, it poses a very serious challenge. So giving ourselves an accurate signal in the marketplace of the true cost of the choices we make, I think is very important. Politically, that's supposed to be, off-limits, and effectively, it is. That's why we have to change the nature of the political dialogue and confront reality. I'm in favor of it, but it'll only happen when the political reality is changed. The solution to this problem is, in total, not politically feasible now. All that means is we have to expand the boundaries of what is politically feasible. We've done that before, and we've done that
before. Sure. Why was the environment such a non-issue in the last election for both parties?
There's a so-called A list of issues and a B list of issues and a C list of issues. And if a candidate that you and I support goes out and makes a terrific speech and a bold proposal on the global environment, and the media doesn't see it on the A list of issues, it doesn't get covered or it's on page B39. And the feedback to the campaigns is, you can use this valuable day to get some traction, or you can waste it on the most important issue that we face. And in the context of a political campaign, they adjust. And it's a brutal fact of the way our politics operate. Our political system is badly broken in this country. It does not work. We have a series of catastrophically bad public decisions. Okay? The fact that three-quarters of the American people believe that Saddam Hussein was responsible for the attacks of 9/11 is the single most prominent symptom of how badly our political system has decayed. If the way we talk to ourselves and share information about the reality we face is so flawed that massive falsehoods survive for extended periods of time in the mind of a majority of the people, then why are we surprised that terrible decisions end up being made within the political process? And it happens time and time again. The fact is that for a long period, knowledge mediated between power and wealth. During the Enlightenment, during the period when fact-based argument played the major role in deciding the outcome of public decisions, that era has passed. Because now, even though fact-based argument continues to play an important role, the political system is now so warped and distorted by the influence of money, not just in campaign contributions. Okay, that's just a tiny part of the problem. The fact is that messages that are simple and repeated over and over and over again on television now shape public attitudes toward the problems that we face and the opportunities that we face. And access to the constant repetition of these simplistic messages is not equally distributed. It's available to the wealthy, to those who have a single passionate concern on some narrow matter that's not broadly shared. But the mass of us who want to build a bright future for America and who want to make rational decisions on the basis of facts, we now do not have access to a public dialogue that is based on rationality. It's propaganda too often that determines the outcome of public events. So this crisis is the single most serious example of a stark reality that we are ignoring because powerful interests want to put a hood over our eyes and say, no, don't look. Don't look at that. Because it'll cost us money if you get exercised about it and make decisions in the democratic process that lead us to change our business plan. And the business plan itself for the oil and coal industry is already obsolete. It's just a question of how many more years they will milk the maximum profit before we somehow throw off these illusions and demand that our nation confront reality. Now, it's just that stark and just that simple. But going person to person and room to room, if we have to, that's what it's going to take to get rid of it. Let me take one final point. In Russia today, Putin is a dictator. Democracy was nice while it lasted over there. But look carefully at what he does. He controls everything on television. Not a word is spoken or put on the screen that he doesn't control. But he lets the newspapers run free through whatever they want. Criticism, it doesn't matter. He said to one of his former prime ministers, "What do we know for the newspapers?" And the elites have the illusion that there's democracy. But the only thing that matters is what is in the mass electronic media. Our media is not controlled, not in that way, we know that. But it is managed by a smaller and smaller group of conglomerates. And a lot of those who participate, some of you, anybody here have an invisible fence for a pet? You can't see the fence, but if the pet gets close to the fence, the dog gets close to it, it shies away. That something like that happens in our political discourse in the mass electronic media. And it is time we put a stop to it.
The last question is, what is your hope that, what is your hope of what could be accomplished in the next year or two?
In one of the slides that I showed, I made the point that the global climate system is a nonlinear system. We get accustomed to change that's gradual and slow and predictable. But sometimes the potential for change builds up. And even though no apparent change is visible, some additional event occurs and it unleashes a sudden change. That also happens in the political system. California, as I said, is offering leadership. The Northeastern Compact States, the state of Washington, the state of Oregon, lots of individual cities are stepping forward to offer leadership. But my fondest hope is that person to person, the truth about what we confront will be shared, and that in spite of this quasi-hypnotic state, that, you know, if you turn on, what's on the news today? The Michael Jackson.
Yeah.
And then there's the trial of the who lost his hand. And then there's another celebrity trial of some sort. Hello? Please, what is going on here? My hope is that we'll penetrate that veil, and that from the grassroots up, the owners have pointed out this, but I really believe that we will find a way on the internet and in our social networks and among people who we trust. And regardless of ideology, incidentally, there are now some right-wing conservatives who have taken the time to look at this and are saying, oh, wait a minute. A lot of the conservative evangelical groups are now saying, the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. How can we praise the Creator and keep content from the creation? There are a lot of new alliances that are opening up as possibilities. My hope is that each of you, and I'm deadly serious about this, I hope that you really hear this voice, I'm real serious, that each of you will find in your own sphere, in your life, ways to connect on this issue and bring about the massive change that's required. Thank you very much.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you, everybody.